Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Reality on BBS Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Kerr. Tonight, I am thrilled to be back on the air with one of my favorite people, Greg Braden. New York Times best-selling author Greg Braden has been a featured guest for international conferences and media specials exploring the power of science and spirituality. A former senior computer systems designer for Martin Marietta Aerospace, computer geologist for Phillips Petroleum, and the technical operations manager for Cisco Systems, Braden is considered a pioneer in bridging the wisdom of our past with the science, healing, and peace of our future. For more than 20 years, Greg has searched the high mountain villages, remote monasteries, ancient temples, and forgotten texts to uncover their timeless secrets. His search led to the 2004 release of his paradigm-shattering book, The God Code, revealing words of the ancient message coded into the DNA of all life. Between 1998 and 2005, Greg's journeys into the monasteries of central Tibet revealed a forgotten form of prayer that we're going to talk about tonight that was lost during the biblical edits of the early Christian church. In his newest book, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, he documents this mode of prayer that has no words or outward expression, yet gives us direct access to the quantum force that connects all things. From his groundbreaking book, Awakening to Zero Point, to the intimacy of walking between the worlds and the controversy of the Isaiah effect, Greg's work awakens the best in each of us, inspiring our deepest passions with the tools to build a better world. And you can visit Greg's website at gregbraden.com. That's GREGGBRADEN.com. And tonight we're going to discuss the secrets of the lost mode of prayer. Greg, it is a thrill to welcome you back to Beyond Reality.
Well, Dr. Kerr, it is a joy and a pleasure to be here. May I call you Shelley this evening?
Yes, please.
All right.
Please.
And I understand that this is your very first program on this network, and I'm absolutely thrilled and honored to be your first guest as well. So,
yeah, I take it as a sign, Greg. You were on the show when I was on KLAF in Dallas for 30 minutes, and then you were on my first night when I had an hour, and now here you are again.
Well, you know, I'd forgotten about that. That's right. So we have a pattern here. We're following patterns.
When I realized this was happening, I was like, wait a minute. Whenever
Greg's
going to be on the show,
very beautiful pattern. And Shelley, thank you for the beautiful introduction as well. After hearing the introduction, I'm really excited to talk about this book tonight now.
I love your book. Let me tell you, I am a fan. I mean, I've read everything you've ever done, and I want to say that this new book is not only the best thing that you've ever written, but it is also so beautiful to look at. The pictures,
you know, I can take credit for only part of that, Shelley. My publisher, Hay House, when they saw the manuscript for this book, immediately shifted gears and placed in a different category, because for those that may be familiar with our work in the past, this is a very, very different book for me to have written. It is a very healing book. It's very personal. It's very non-technical. It is easy to read on the one hand. On the other hand, there are huge concepts, I mean, life-altering concepts, that just flow from the page so easily, and it's so beautifully illustrated. Every page is a glossy page that has the pictures from the temples and the sacred texts from all over the world that we're referencing in this book called Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. And all through every department, from the graphics and art to the designers and the editors, everyone took just a very special liking and had a very special connection with this book, and they're all just so proud of it, as I am as well. So thank you for that. Haven't read it yet, if you go to the bookstore, you only have to buy it. Just pick it up and flip through the pages. Very, very cool pictures.
Everybody should buy it, though. I'm telling you that this book is not only stunning to look at, but I'm serious. It really spoke to me. I thought it was I love everything you've ever done, but I really feel that this is your best work yet.
Well, thank you. Thank
it
you, Shelley.
So
you know, our work in the past, a lot of it has been because of the nature of the material. It has been a little technical for credibility. If you're going to claim, for example, that the name of God is in the DNA of all life, You've got to show how that works, and by virtue of that, it becomes a little technical. This book is about a language that has no words and no outer expression. It's a language that speaks to what Western scientists now have acknowledged is a field of energy that bathes all of creation. It permeates every aspect of our experience. It's not a field that's out there somewhere. We literally are a part of this field. It's part of who we are. And because Western science now acknowledges this field is there, number one, and number two, they acknowledge the power of human emotion to affect and change this field, and by virtue of that, to change our physical world. Western physicists now have acknowledged this. The question they're asking is, okay, these relationships are there. They say, what do we do with it? What does this mean? And for me, this is the beauty of marrying spirituality and science. Because what we know is 1,700 years ago, in the Western traditions, our knowledge of this field was lost. It was edited right out of our most cherished texts and traditions, and we can talk about that tonight. So without knowledge of how this relationship works in our world, we've gone this technical route, and we've pushed science about as far as we can without bringing spirituality back into the fold and coming full circle and saying that the spirituality tells us how we apply the science in our lives. So this book was a very healing book for me to write about going beyond our immediate culture into the ancient text, into the ancient cultures where this relationship is still alive, and being able to write about it from personal experience in a very non-technical way, saying this is how this modality of prayer works, and this is how we apply it in our lives.
I'm talking to Greg Braden. You can visit him online at gregbraden.com. Greg, several years ago when I first interviewed you about the Isaiah effect, you told me at that time, you described that this is a whole series, that the Isaiah effect was just one piece of this whole puzzle. How has the Isaiah effect moved into the God code, which I would like to talk about too, and then come into the new book about the secrets of the lost mode of prayer? How did they all fit together?
So you're going to ask me the really easy questions in the first 15 minutes of the night, huh? All of our books, as different as each one appears from the others, there's a common thread that binds them together, and that thread is that they are all designed to help us better understand our relationship to the world around us, and to a world beyond the obvious that we see in our everyday lives. And through that understanding, help us to become better people. And as we can become better people, we create a better world. So that's the thread of commonality that runs through all of these books. The Isaiah effect spoke about this field of energy that links all of creation, and the way we went about discovering it back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. In broad general terms and in stories of direct experience, this book, now, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, is a very specific aspect of what the Isaiah effect was talking about, this modality of prayer. Might as well, I'll just jump right in and talk about this a little bit right now.
Okay, great.
Western prayer researchers identify four modalities of prayer that we use in some combination in the West. When they say that when we pray, traditionally we use one of these four modes of prayer. And what I know is that when we talk about prayer, it's something that's very personal for everyone. It means something a little different to everyone. And I'm going to begin our evening by saying there are no incorrect modalities of prayer. There are no wrong ways to pray. However, these four modes that have been identified by Western researchers, there's always been another mode that we find in the temple walls, in the ancient texts, and we find it in the living cultures. Shelley, it's a mode that simply does not fit into any of these four categories. It's a fifth mode, and what we now know is a mode of prayer that was lost to the West 1,700 years ago in the 4th century, when the details for this mode of prayer were edited out of our Western Christian traditions by the early Christian church. And I'm not saying that's right, wrong, good, or bad. It simply is a fact.
Right.
25 books were completely removed, and another 20 were edited and condensed into what we now know as the Western Christian Bible. And as good as our Bible is, best scholars will tell you it's incomplete. Part of that incompleteness we know about because of the Dead Sea Scrolls and through the Da Vinci Code now, we all know about the Nag Hammadi Library, the oldest records of the Old and New Testaments. And so, since we have found those records, we've found the descriptions of this mode of prayer that was, in fact, part of the early Christian tradition before it was edited. So this modality of prayer, it's not tied to any one religion or any, it's a non-denominational mode of prayer. It has no words or outward expression. It is based in a quality of feeling that we all create inside of our bodies, or we can create in our bodies. And it is this quality of feeling that ties the spirituality to the science. Because what the mode of prayer says is that if we can feel the feeling in our bodies as if our prayer has already been answered and give thanks of gratitude and appreciation for the prayer already coming to pass, rather than feeling helpless and powerless in our world and saying, "Dear God," or "Dear angels, please intervene on my behalf and help me out," which is good, and we all do it from time to time. This mode of prayer simply acknowledges that we are empowered in some situations to participate in the outcome. And I'm going to use that word very intentionally. It's not about control or manipulation or imposing our will on the world. It's not about that. It is about us participating in the outcome of the healing in our loved ones, or the peace in our families, or our communities, or even the peace between nations. So what Western scientists have found is that this field of energy that links everything together, of the many functions it serves, one of those functions is it's like a mirror. What we feel inside, this field mirrors back as the events around us. So when we feel anger, hate, rage, jealousy inside of us, we shouldn't be surprised to see the field mirror that back as angry friendships and angry relationships and angry coworkers and angry supervisors and things like that. And by the same token, when we can feel love, compassion, understanding, forgiveness on the inside, it's not unusual then to see the field mirror those very things back to us in our relationships as well. So Western scientists have seen us work in the laboratory, and they're saying, how do we apply it in our lives? And the ancient traditions that we can talk about later in this program have preserved the instructions, if you will, for how we go about doing this in our lives. So the book is about marrying those two things together. So we just covered a lot of ground in 20 minutes, so that we can tie back into those concepts for the rest of the program and really flesh out these ideas.
Yeah, there's so much we can talk about. You're listening to Beyond Reality on BBS Radio. I'm Dr. Shelley Kerr, and you're listening to Greg Braden. You can give us a call tonight at 1-888-268-4313. Greg, my favorite part of the book is one of the secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, talking about how hurt teaches us, and your description of the dark night of the soul, I thought was the most profound that I've ever read, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, I certainly can. First, thank you for that, Shelley. The book was released January 1st. We're still getting feedback. We just started the interviews and the media coverage this last week, so it's good for me to hear. It was meaningful, too, in your life as well. What the book describes in five very, very clear chapters are five secrets that the ancients, specifically the ancient Essenes, and in their texts, and now the Tibetans, who are living these traditions in the monasteries, and we can talk about where and how we found that out. But the book describes these five secrets. The first of them we've already talked about, the fact that there's a field of energy out there that simply mirrors and reflects what we feel in our bodies. That's the first secret. The second is the purpose or the role that hurt plays in our lives. And what the texts and the traditions say is that hurt and wisdom are very closely related. They are at opposite ends of the spectrum of the same line of experience. So when we, and I know that everyone listening to this program has experienced hurt in their lives before, and I know that hurt means different things to different people. What these traditions say is that hurt, when we hurt, one of the things that our hurt tells us is how deep our capacity for love really is. Because the greater that we can feel hurt in our lives, the greater our capacity to experience that love as well. So I know when people hear that, they say, wow, you know, I've had some really deep hurts in my life that I've tried really hard to forget or move beyond. And the truth is that those greatest hurts are telling us, if we have the wisdom to understand it, really how deep our capacity to love is. And people say, well, if I can hurt that bad, I must really be capable of a lot of love. And that's precisely where these secrets in the mode of prayer are going. And we redefine what the hurt has meant to us. The transition from hurt to wisdom is a very powerful transition. It doesn't change what has happened to us. It changes the meaning of what has happened to us, our perceptions and our interpretations. In the dark night of the soul, this is a long answer, paving the way to so that I can share what you've just asked me to share. The dark night of the soul is an experience that everyone will have at some point in their lives where their greatest fears are realized. And when they find themselves in the place of losing everything that they've ever loved or held dear in that moment in time, that generally is the beginning. That's the hallmark of what is called the dark night of the soul. And how we come out of that experience, what we learn from that experience and how we interpret it, is where we either gain the greatest power that we'll ever have in our lives, or where we find ourselves locked and enmeshed in a way of thinking that that saps the life right out of our bodies. And I know that you've seen it go both ways in your work, and I have as well with my friends. So it's the dark night of the soul. The very interesting thing about a dark night of the soul is once someone goes through a dark night successfully and they look back and they say, wow, I made it through the dark night of the soul, there's this feeling that they can take on anything that crosses their path, and they almost dare the universe to bring on the next dark night of the soul because they feel so empowered by the last one. And it happens time and time again that these experiences that help us to recognize our greatest fears are really the most powerful teachers. So I know we all know that maybe intellectually, and what the stories in the book do is share case histories and real-life experiences to really, at a heart level, help to understand. When you read about someone else's dark night, you can identify with it and say, oh, yeah, you know, I had something like that happen to me, and maybe that's what it was trying to tell me.
Yeah.
That was the reason for sharing the stories as I shared them in the book.
The case studies were wonderful, and you're right that it really helps people to relate to that. You also talk about why we die. Can you talk about that for a minute? That is very interesting.
And that is it was. I question whether or not I could even do justice to the topic in a few brief pages or in a chapter of this book. On the one hand, the other hand, I felt really strongly about sharing that. It almost warrants an entire interview, an entire book on its own. I asked a question that I've asked in front of live audiences many times. I'll ask people, I say, why do you think we die? And, you know, of course, there's a lot of laughs and people kind of snicker and they say, well, you know, it's obvious why we die. And so I say, okay, give me some reasons. And aside from things like war and car accidents and drug overdoses and things like that, if we can survive all those things in life, people say it comes down to old age. And I find that fascinating. And I say, well, tell me about old age. Tell me what that means to you. And they say, well, you know, when you get older, these things in your body start to break down and things don't work the way they used to, and systems begin to give out. And while it's certainly true for a lot of people, the question is, why do those happen? One of the reasons it's such a mystery, Shelley, is because within just the last couple of years, scientists have made a discovery that, to me, changes everything about the way we see our bodies. We know that our cells, the cells in our bodies, have the capability of reproducing themselves almost infinitely in life. That was true, we thought, for every organ in the body except the brain and the heart. And we've always heard that brain and the heart can't reproduce their own cells. Because the original cells are so resilient, it seems like they never have to. But what researchers found, and I document this in the book, is under laboratory conditions, they've found that the heart and the brain, in fact, are capable of reproducing themselves, reproducing the cells. So what we can say now is every organ in the body has the capability of the cells reproducing themselves again and again and again. And you say, well, if that's true, then what is it that causes the aging in our bodies, and why is it that we appear to break down as we go through life? And what is it that really steals from us the very thing that we cherish the most, our lives? Up until a couple of years ago, the number one killer of adults in the Western world was heart disease. And I found this fascinating because our heart is such a powerful, resilient organ. When you read the statistics of how many times a minute and how many minutes in a day and how many days in the average lifespan, our heart works the way it works. It's such a vital organ. To think that it would suddenly break down and stop all of a sudden makes no sense whatsoever to me. And it doesn't to a lot of scientists either. And what they found, and to make a long story very brief, what they found is it is the quality of our emotions and the way we feel about our lives that determine how well our heart functions and how long it lives in our bodies. And this ties in precisely to the ancient spiritual traditions of transforming the hurt in our lives. Because if we carry the hurts with us, and if we allow the hurts to linger year after year, decade after decade, for the job opportunity that passed us by, or for the love that failed, or for the person that left us before we were ready to end a relationship, if we harbor those things, what the studies are showing is that they literally steal from us the very thing that we cherish the most, and that is our lives. And it looks like the average heart can only sustain that kind of hurt between 80 and 100 years before the systems just break down and it simply doesn't function any longer, on the one hand. On the other hand, there are documented instances of people living well beyond that 80 or 100-year mark. In central China and in Tibet, there are both men and women 140, 160 years old. They're documented as living that old. I think in North America, I think 120 is the oldest documented. I just heard this on the news just a few weeks ago. They were celebrating, and it's very rare. You don't see it happen much here. And you look at these people and you say, if one of us can do it, then everyone can do it, because we all have access to the same equipment, to the same tools in our bodies. So the question in this chapter is it possible that the hurt in our lives ultimately is what steals from us the life that we cherish so dearly as individuals? And then we take it one step further and ask if there is perhaps a universal hurt. We've all heard that we are, in fact, souls, if you will, that have differentiated from a mass experience into our individual experiences? Is it possible that when we come into our bodies that we so long for the union that our souls have known before they fragmented into individual bodies, that there's a universal hurt that we all feel, may not always acknowledge it consciously, but that actually could be out there. And that when we have our individual hurts in our lives, our loss of our jobs or our loss of the people that we love and hold dear or our pets, one of the reasons that they hurt so deeply is because it ties us into a greater or a deeper or a more universal fear. So that's the Reader's Digest condensed version of a possibility that's posed in the book that I think is fascinating. And I believe Norm Shealy has just written a book. I don't know if it's released yet, so I don't know if I should even say this. But no,
it's just you and me.
He's writing a book asking the same question, and what the modern research and science is showing is we should be here. We've got bodies that should be lasting us at least 140 years or more, almost twice the lifespan of what is acknowledged to be the average in the industrialized world. And the question is, why aren't we fulfilling that lifespan? And whether you're looking at it from a spiritual, a medical, or a scientific point of view, it all comes down to the power of human emotion and how it creates stress in our bodies, what it does to our blood pressure, what it does to the quality of the arteries inside of our bodies, and all of those things ultimately are linked to the longevity. It all boils down to how we feel about our lives, and that is where Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer plays, I believe, such a powerful role. So that's the chapter you were asking about?
I love it. Yes.
Okay.
This is Beyond Reality on BBS Radio. You're listening to Greg Braden. I'm Dr. Shelley Kerr. You can visit my website at beyondrealityshow.com, and you can visit on the web at gregbraden.com. You know, this that you mentioned about the universal hurt, though, really does, it is supported by the first secret about the field, right?
Yes.
I mean, of course, if the field is filled with positive things, then of course it could potentially be filled with the universal hurt as well. I think that makes total sense.
Sure, sure. And the existence of this field, excuse me, is it's no longer hypothetical. It's pretty well acknowledged in the scientific circles who are studying and researching these things. Between 1993 and the year 2000, the experiments under laboratory conditions bore out the fact that this field exists. You won't perhaps see it in the textbooks because historically it takes 8 to 10 years for new ideas to pass all the peer review and for it to catch up in the textbooks. So in many respects, the physics that's being taught in classrooms, both elementary and secondary in college texts now, are out of date because they are not taking into account the fact that this field exists that connects everything together. The field that is being called the holographic field, and that very term has implications all its own. But the fact that this field is there changes everything about the way we see our world and the way we live our lives. The field has been identified as performing three key functions. It is a container for all experience that we'll ever know. It is a bridge between the inner and the outer worlds by its holographic nature. So it is a container. It is a bridge. And thirdly, it is also a mirror. So the field you can think of as a glimmering, shimmering, living, pulsing field of essence that mirrors back to us what we create in our imagination, in our perceptions, in our thoughts, our feelings, and our emotions. And it performs all three functions simultaneously. And those are huge concepts, Shirley. Shirley, I mean, it warrants an entire book, an entire program unto
right.
itself. But
absolutely.
We're using it as a backdrop to understand precisely why this mode of prayer is so powerful, because the mode of prayer is based in what we feel. So if the field is mirroring feelings back to us in every moment of every day, all of a sudden it becomes really important for us to understand what we're feeling and how we feel about what's happened to us in our lives, and how to redefine those experiences so that we can feel the kinds of feelings to give us a positive and joyous experiences down the road.
Okay.
Other than that, not much going on with this field.
Right, yeah, just a few things, no big deal.
Before our hour gets away, by the way, I want to say congratulations to you on the success of your new books, and thank you for all the work that you're doing in addition to doing this this program this evening. A lot of good information out there, and I want to thank you for being such a gracious host and for creating the forum so that we can have these kinds of conversations and these kinds of discussions tonight. And our hour always has a way of getting away from us, so I wanted to get that in before it winds down at the top of the hour.
Thanks, Greg. You and I are going to be speaking this year at the 8th International Conference on Science and Consciousness.
I saw that.
This is April 21st through the 26th, and if people want to find out about it, you can either go to my website at galactichealing.org and click on events. You can check Greg's website out at greggraden.com, or go to bizspirit.com/science.
I'll be speaking about the field that we're talking about now, about specific implications of the field at that conference, and it's going to be in my beautiful home state of New Mexico.
Yes.
So.
My home state when I was a kid state of New Mexico, but now I'm in Texas. I don't know why, but
well, you're right next to your beautiful home state.
Yes.
That's why.
So I can pop right over there whenever I want. I wrote a book on parallel universes, and I explore time. And you and I have discussed time in the past. And we were talking about when I read this that you were writing about how the first 100 years may be the hardest for us to maintain the hurt, and that maybe we can get past it after that. I was thinking about the Tibetans because of the fact that they really have so many who are living to be 140. And do you think, so here's the question in this, do you think that the reason why they are able to sustain such an extended lifetime is because of the fact maybe that they don't wear watches?
Oh, absolutely, Shelley.
They don't wear
it goes even even beyond that. It's I left my career in the defense industry at the end of the Cold War, and I was trained as a scientist. And actually, I left at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday on March 17th, 1990. That's when I left that career.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. When I began my search to understand the principles that we're talking about tonight, I began looking the way I was trained as a scientist in the world around me. And it made sense to me. If we were going to find this kind of information, it made perfect sense to me to go to places in the world that have been least disturbed by Western civilization, and Tibet was right up there on the top of the list. It wasn't until 1998, however, that I had the opportunity to go there the first time. I've just come back from two separate journeys, each one 22 days long in August, in July and August of 2005. So we've been there relatively recently. And one of the many things we've learned from Tibetans, of the many things that they share with us and teach us, is their concept of time. And it's always just hilarious to me. If you ask a Tibetan how old they are, the first thing they'll do is laugh. Because they really don't know, because they really don't care. And then what they'll say, if you really want to know, they'll say, you know, tell me what year this is. Of course, they know what year they were born, and they'll take a pencil and they'll figure it out. You know, they'll look and they'll say, oh, look, I'm 130 years old. Ha, 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 you know.
Wow.
I think it really, I think there is something to not thinking about each day as that day bringing you closer to the end of your life, or another day that your body is deteriorated. What Western science, one of the things Western science has discovered in the last years of the 20th century is that for every feeling and emotion we create in our bodies, there is a chemistry in our bodies that matches that feeling and that emotion. So when we are experiencing the feelings and emotions of anger, hate, rage, jealousy, a staying level, not if it passes, these are experiences we all have at various times in our lives, and I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with having them, but it's when we are locked into those feelings, day after day, month after month, year after year, our body chemistry begins to mirror those kinds of emotions. Anger, hate, rage, jealousy are life-denying emotions, and they create the kind of chemistry in our bodies that shortens our lives. It takes life from us. High levels of stress hormones, cortisol, shuts down the output of life-affirming hormones, lowers our immune response. And the flip side of that is true as well. When we can look at life and interpret our experiences through love, understanding, compassion, forgiveness, there's a chemistry that matches that. Increased DHEA levels, the precursor to all the other hormones in the body, lowered stress hormones of cortisol, a high immune response. And even if you don't do the science, we all know that. We know that people who are generally happy in life have a higher immune response and seem to live longer. So if you extrapolate that over a lifetime and think about what that really means, if you're not keeping track of your age and you don't wake up every morning thinking, oh, I'm another day older, that may just in fact be a very powerful life-affirming way of creating the chemistry in our bodies that defies many of the beliefs about what aging really means. So the Tibetans go through life. Each day they'll be older than they were the day before, but their bodies don't deteriorate necessarily in the same way. And I don't want to mislead our audience. Not every single person in Tibet does this, but we've seen the monks and the nuns and the abbots in the monasteries. These are the people that we interface with the most, and this is where we've seen this the most. So they're also the people that we've had the opportunity to ask about this mode of prayer that we're speaking about in this book, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. 1998 was the very first time we had a translator with us, and every monk and every nun and every abbot that crossed my path, I asked the same question. I know they got tired of hearing it. And when I asked them, I said, okay, when we see your prayers on the outside, when we see you in these chanting halls with the bells and the bowls and the gongs and the chimes and the mudras and the mantras, and you're chanting 12 and 14, 16, 18 hours a day, when we see you do this on the outside, so what are you doing on the inside? What's happening? And it was through asking these questions that finally one abbot was very, very clear in his answer. And I wrote about this in the book, The Isaiah Effect, and I also write about it in Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. Mm-hmm. And this was the abbot that said to us, chuckled at first when I asked this question, and he said, you've never seen our prayers, because a prayer cannot be seen. He said, what you have seen are the things that we do to create feeling inside of our bodies. And the feeling is the prayer. So the feeling is the prayer, not the words. And then he turned the question on me through the translator. He says, well, how do you do this in your culture? He assumed that we know how to do the same thing. And that was when I began to think, in our culture, more often, there are always exceptions, Shelley, but more often than not, if you ask someone about a prayer, we believe that the prayers are the words. We believe if we say the right words, the right time of day or the right time of year, God is great, God is good, or now I lay me down to sleep, we think we've said the prayer. When in reality, it appears that the words you can think of as the code that are designed to trigger an emotion inside of our bodies, a feeling. And the feeling is the prayer, not the words. So it's, and this is precisely what quantum physicists are finding under laboratory conditions, that when we feel a certain feeling, we're affecting matter on a physical level around us. This is the whole crux of the controversy about what quantum physics means in our lives today. When scientists go to observe matter on the subatomic level, what they found is they cannot be passive observers. The act of looking at subatomic particles changes the way those particles behave. They act one way when we aren't looking at them, and they act another way when we do. So the very act of consciousness focusing itself in a point in time and observing nature changes nature. And by virtue of that, what physicists now are saying is it's impossible to be just an observer. There are no observers. We are all creators. And the act of being conscious is an act of creation unto itself. And this is precisely what, very different language, of course, but this is what the Tibetans are saying to us in this this lost modality of prayer.
Amazing. You're listening to Beyond Reality. I'm talking to Greg Braden. Greg, here's another thing I think about. In our Western medical culture, you know, people are taught that they need to go get a checkup. And I'm really getting into this energy lately that a lot of the diseases that people have are probably because they're observing things and focusing on those instead of doing what you're talking about, which would be to focus on positive, life-affirming things. And that a lot of this devastation that people are going through physically, in my mind, is not necessary.
Well, I would tend to agree with you, Shelley, and also I know that this is an area where it's a very delicate area, and it's one that, although we only have a few moments, I think it's important to talk about these things really responsibly.
Right.
And Western medicine is amazing medicine, and we do some amazing things here, and especially in the realm of trauma response and things like that. On the one hand, on the other hand, one of the things that's been found is we look at cancer, for example. Cancer is something that we don't find in the wild, in nature, in non-domesticated animals. The only animals that have cancer are those that are domesticated or whose consciousness, if you will, is linked to ours: dogs, cats, horses, cows, pigs, things like that. It's something you don't find in nature. Humans didn't have it until our lifestyles changed during the industrial age. And I think these, I think they're fascinating statistics, and I think they tell us something about the way that we live our lives. I think it's interesting how a condition can be discovered in the laboratory, and once it hits mainstream media, all of a sudden that condition shows up everywhere from people thinking about it and wondering maybe they have that condition. And this is classic. You see this in college all the time, especially psychology classes.
Oh, yeah. That happened to me in psychology class. Yeah,
well, you know, you read the psychology book, and they're going through all the symptoms of what certain conditions mean, and all of a sudden you're saying, well, you know, I've had that symptom before, or I've felt like that before. And, of course, at some time in our lives, we'll all feel like one thing or the other. It's whether or not they all happen in the same moment in time or not. But I think there is... we know is this. We can speculate about all these things, but here's what we know to be true.
Okay.
We know that the field responds to human emotion and human feelings. And when we can feel the feeling, life-affirming feelings in our bodies, when we can feel fully enabled, fully capacitated, vital in our lives, and give thanks of gratitude and appreciation for those feelings, we know that the field responds to that. And when the field responds to it, it creates physical changes in our bodies. I have a video that I've shared in many of our live presentations.
Yes.
Where you must have seen this in one of the
incredible
programs.
Incredible, yes.
And it's one of those experiences where I think a picture truly is worth many, many words that we could have in a conversation. And it's a video of an ultrasound inside the body of a living woman. I guess today they're calling them sonograms now. Inside the body of a living woman in a medicineless hospital in Beijing, China, who has what doctors consider to be an inoperable condition in her body. It's a cancerous tumor. And Western medical doctors say, well, we can't do anything for her, so she should be comfortable till the end of her days. In the part of the world where this video was made, they look at these things very differently. And she has three practitioners that surround her, and they begin to feel the feeling as if they are in the presence of a woman who's fully capacitated, fully healed, fully enabled. They don't buy into the illusion of that cancer in her body. They say, sure, it's one possibility of many possibilities. But today we're going to feel as if this woman is a healthy, vital woman. And when they do that, using the training that they have gone through to create these kinds of feelings in their bodies, her body begins to respond to what they're feeling. And we know that because we can see it through the magic of the ultrasound. We can literally see this tumor reverse itself and disappear in less than 3 minutes, real time. It's not time lapse like you see on the Discovery Channel where a rose, you know, opens into full bloom in 5 seconds, and it's really time-lapse over 2 days. It's not like that. This is 2 minutes and 40 seconds. The tumor is gone, and this is something that they do in this part of the world, and they have over a 95% success rate after 5 years when people learn to follow the guidelines of feeling differently in their bodies and certainly life-affirming lifestyles, eating life-affirming foods, moving in gentle life-affirming ways, breathing in life-affirming ways. And these things all seem a little different to us here in the West, perhaps, because this kind of information was lost when our texts were at 1,700 years ago. However, they're almost universal once you leave the Western traditions. You find them throughout the indigenous traditions in North America and little villages in the Andes Mountains, of Bolivia and Peru. We spend a lot of time. You find them in the monasteries in Nepal and India and China and Tibet, references to them in the temple walls in Egypt. So it's kind of like everybody knows except us.
Right. We're always the last to know.
Well, we were among the first, and then we forgot. Now we're the last to know. So when people say, well, how come we don't know about this stuff? I can say, well, we did
right.
At one point. And, you know, the world of science, and I come from the world of science, and I know that you do as well, Shelley, and I honor the world of science and support the scientific method. And just as our most cherished traditions, as good as they are incomplete, and scholars will acknowledge that, by the same token, science, as good as it is today, it's only about 400 years old, and the best scientists will tell you that our science is incomplete. Huge gaps exist in glaring inconsistencies in terms of the way science defines our Western world. And I think it's a beautiful example of where science can describe the nuts and bolts, maybe, of why things work the way they work, on the one hand. And on the other hand, when it comes to applying that knowledge in our lives, those ancient spiritual traditions that have been around, some of them 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, they tell us how to apply those nuts and bolts in our lives. And this is where I think it behooves us, if we can marry our science, the best science of our time, and when we don't know something, just admit it. Say, okay, science does not understand this. However, spiritual traditions do. And marry those together into a wisdom that's greater than the science by itself, or that's greater than the spirituality by itself. And I think, not if, because I'm seeing this happen, so I'll say as we allow ourselves to do this, we are now on the threshold of the greatest empowerment and the greatest wisdom that we may have seen in civilization for a very long time. And I think it's very exciting. So this book and others, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, I think the idea that what happens inside of our bodies is mirrored by a field that surrounds us, and that mirror is what creates the joy and the abundance or the pain and the suffering in our lives, although it's a very different way of looking things, it makes tremendous sense. And once we see those relationships, we have the opportunity to participate in the unfolding of the things, the good things in our lives.
Absolutely. You're listening to Beyond Reality. I'm Shelley Kerr, and I'm talking to Greg Braden. So how can we use this mode? How can we get into that place where we can create this for ourselves?
Well, the book is about specific instructions as they were shared with us in different traditions. I'm hinging much of it on what we found in Tibet. And I think that is the value of going into a living culture. We can go into the temple walls of Egypt or the Mayan hieroglyphs or look at a 2,500-year-old scroll from the Dead Sea, and it may tell us something very similar. And even though we think we can translate those old languages and those old texts, Shelley, to some degree we are speculating, to some degree we guess, because the translations are never 100% perfect, on the one hand. And on the other hand, when we go into a living culture, we can look at a man or woman in the eyes and ask them through a translator or even directly again and again and again until we are very, very clear about how they're creating the effects of healing and how they're doing these things that seem so foreign to our frame of reference. And I think that's the value of going to these old places and finding this kind of wisdom in its purest form. So the specifics of that are in the book. In general, how we apply this in our lives is by becoming very aware, conscious, that what we are feeling, our judgments about other people, our fears, however rational or irrational, about the way our bodies work or about what's happening in our world, the feelings we have in our bodies are a language. And that's the bottom line. Feeling and emotion, it's a language. And it's a language that speaks to this intelligent field that permeates creation. The question is, do we know what we're saying to that field? Number one. And number two, the field answers us. It mirrors back what we're saying in the quality of our jobs and our abundance, our friendships, our marriages, our relationships with our siblings and our parents. All of those are expressions of the field mirroring back to us what we have created. So do we recognize what the field, how the field answers us? That's the second part of the question. So when we find ourselves surrounded by loving, supportive, nurturing relationships, then we can be assured that that is the kind of feeling that we're harboring in our bodies. And we find ourselves surrounded by distrust or betrayals or anger, then at least to some degree, the field is telling us then that's what it is that we're creating in our bodies. And the bottom line to all this is we simply must become the very things that we choose to experience in our world. So we must become compassion. We must become the nurturing. We must become the trust and the integrity that we like to experience in our lives. And that way, we give the field something to work with.
Absolutely.
A long answer to a short question.
I love it.
How come this hour went by so fast?
I don't know. I guess because it's just fun when you're on the show.
Well, it's fun to be on the show. I'm just thrilled to be, again, to be the very first guest on this first evening of your program. So congratulations once again.
Thank you. Congratulations on this beautiful book. I think it's awesome, and I hope that people will get the book. The book is called Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. Hay House is the publisher, and it just was released. Before you go, because we still have a couple more minutes,
mm-hmm.
Talk about blessings and how we can use blessing to allow us to release things so that we can bring more of what we want.
Sure. Blessing is perhaps one of the most misunderstood of the experiences in our Western world. When we talk about blessing things, we generally think that we consent to something or that we agree with it or that we condone it. And by virtue of that, we give it our blessing. And that is only one function of the blessing. And again, the ancient traditions, specifically the Essene traditions, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, tell us that the blessing also provides another function. When you bless something that has hurt you, and that's where blessing comes into this book, blessing the things that hurt us, you're not condoning, you're not consenting, you're not agreeing or saying it's good, bad, right, or wrong, or that you ever want to have it happen again. All that you are doing when you bless something that hurts you is you are acknowledging that it has happened. And in that acknowledgement, it is if the blessing then becomes an emotional lubricant. Blessing the things that hurt us rather than having them stuck and contracted as a hurtful feeling inside of our bodies. When we can bless the things that have hurt us, they begin to move, that emotion begins to move through our bodies so that it can be replaced with something else. And again, it's a very different way of looking at blessing from the Western perspective, and I acknowledge that. It's also one of the best-kept secrets and is one of the most powerful catalysts, Shelley, for transforming and transcending in our lives something that shocks us or something that hurts us by breaking the hurt cycle long enough for us to replace it with something else. And that's precisely the way it's described in the book.
They told me I could run over a couple minutes, so talk for a moment, if
sure.
you would, about how beauty then, after we've blessed, allows the whole transformation to occur.
Well, I'd be happy to do that, and to do that, I'm going to go back to the blessing and give a specific example. The reason I can speak passionately about these things because I've used them in my life, and they've worked in my life time and time again. When the hurt of losing my father unexpectedly, actually it was on the first day of my book tour for the book The God Code, is when my father died.
Sorry to hear that.
Or when I was in Europe on a book tour, and I came back to my hotel room, and it was when the journalist Daniel Pearl had been beheaded. And the media carried that, and it was such a shock to all of us in the West, because we're not used to hearing things like that. And I had such a visceral response, and the contraction in my body, and I had to apply, this is the only way I knew to deal with it, and I applied the gift of the blessing. And in the blessing, you bless all aspects of something that hurts. And that experience hurt me. Daniel Pearl's murder, it hurt me. And I had to bless Daniel Pearl in the loss of his life. I also had to bless those who took his life, and that's the hard part. And I had to bless myself because I was the one in that room who was watching it. All of us, all three of us, were part of it. I didn't mean that I consented or condoned or agreed with what happened, but the blessing acknowledged that it happened. And as I did it again and again, I felt this warmth well up from the pit of my stomach that ended up as tears in my eyes. And that is the lubricant of the hurt and the shock passing long enough to be able to replace that hurt with something else. And in the book, what I talk about is the power of beauty is the transformer. We replace our hurt with the power of beauty. And beauty means different things to different people. It's about finding beauty. The ancients tell us that beauty already exists everywhere in our world. We don't have to create it. Our job is to seek it out, to find it in all things. Just as Mother Teresa would find beauty in the streets of Calcutta, in the stench and the filth and the decay of what was in the gutters, she would find a pile of cow dung. And in that dung, there would be a flower growing, and in that flower, she would find beauty in the streets of Calcutta. And when I read those kinds of stories of Mother Teresa, I know she can find beauty in cow dung. I can find it anywhere in the world, and it's we have a whole chapter on the power of beauty to transform the hurt in our lives. Before you can do that, you've got to break that hurt cycle, and that is what the gift of the blessing does for us. So in a nutshell, that's those are huge concepts in just a few brief moments.
Absolutely.
On the radio.
You know,
on the one hand, on the other hand, they give some idea of what Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer are really all about.
Yeah, this is an amazing book. You mentioned your tears, and this is something that I try to talk to clients about all the time. I think people are afraid of having to cry to, you know, you have to remember and experience a little bit so that you can cry it out. But I really believe that that is the healing, as you've described here. That is the lubricant that allows it to move through so that the real healing can begin.
It is, Shelley. It's an expression of the only way those tears happen is for, if you think of the emotion literally as a substance that's moving through your body.
Mm-hmm.
And when something hurts us, our immediate response is to contract, to tighten down, and to try to sweep that hurt under our intellectual rug somewhere so we don't have to deal with it. And especially as males in the Western world, in the past, that has been the conditioning. What the blessing does, rather than the contraction that promises that that hurt stays with us for a long time, it is the release. It is the emotional lubricant. When you bless something again and again and again, especially the things that hurt you, you bless those that have been hurt, those that perpetrate the hurt, and those that experience. We talk about all this in the book. There are actually forms you can fill out to take yourself or your loved ones through these experiences. This is one of the places where words begin to fail, and you just have to have the experience. You say, well, just blessing something isn't going to change it. And I agree on the one hand. On the other hand, I have to say, it doesn't change what happens, but it can change the way we feel about what happens. And this is where direct experience is the only way to really know the power of this gift. And again, the blessing is one of those things that was edited from our texts. In the 4th century, in the year 325 A.D., here we are 1,700 years later, looking for the clues in 1,700-year-old texts that will help us get through the greatest hurts of the 21st century, both individually in our families and collectively as nations. So I don't know what's going to happen this year, 2006, or the next few years. I know we're all in for some big stuff. And when we find ourselves faced with things where our conventional tools fail us, Shelley, I think that's the power of this lost mode of prayer. It's all about what we feel. And feeling literally is a technology. It's a language. And this book helps us to redefine what it is that we feel to empower our lives and to turn our hurts into life-affirming feelings of beauty and passion. And I think that's where the healing really begins. So I want to thank you for your support and for your enthusiasm about what this book says. It tells me that you really did read the book, and I appreciate it.
I read the book, Greg, and I want to tell everybody out there, you need to read this book. Mm-hmm. I hope everybody will read this book. I am talking to Greg Braden, and you can visit Greg online at gregbraden.com. You can also see Greg and I at the 8th International Conference on Science and Consciousness in Santa Fe, New Mexico, April 21st. Through 26th. Greg, thank you so much for being so wonderful. And I think this is the most beautiful book you've ever done. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Right back, Shelley. Thank you again for being such a gracious host. And I'm going to come to your program at Science and Consciousness. I'll see you there, if not before.
Great.
All right. God bless.
God bless.
And good night.
Good night. You've been listening to Beyond Reality on BBS Radio. I'm Dr. Shelley Kerr. You can visit our Beyond Reality radio show website at www.beyondrealityshow.com. You can visit my personal website at www.galactichealing.org. We will be on BBS Radio every Tuesday night from 11 to 12. Coming up next week, January 31st, I've got Jean-Claude Coven, author of Going Deeper, will join me. You're going to love this book. February 7th, I am thrilled to be welcoming Fred Allen Wolf, the world-renowned physicist from the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? And on Valentine's Day, yours truly, we'll discuss my work in past life regression, parallel universes, and the creation of your reality. And coming up February 21st, I've got Dan Millman, who you may know because he is author of a really great book called Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And his new book is what we're going to be discussing, Journeys of Socrates. Visit the show online for upcoming show information at beyondrealityshow.com. You can contact me by email at drshelley@galactichealing.org or by telephone by calling area code 469 556-HEAL, which is 4325. Thank you for everyone who's listening, and thanks to all of the staff at BBS Radio. You've been listening to Beyond Reality. I'm Dr. Shelley Kerr. Thank you, and good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and wish you much peace and joy on your journey.